David Allen from the Social Science Research Council was formerly a student in this department and wrote a book called British Tastes. And I wanted to ask you, David, something about the methodology that you used for that, partly because of the interest it had, I think, for possibilities for research in sociology, anthropology, and social sciences generally.
Well, I was employed in market research, commercial survey research, for about 10, 15 years. And I found that people in the market research world and their customers for their work took very little interest in the geographical breakdowns of the data which was collected. This is primarily because it would have been awkward to do anything about many of the major changes if these did show up. For example, if a product had a very much lower sales, should we say, or low consumption in East Anglia, you really couldn't do very much about it. You could try intensive advertising perhaps on Anglia TV or something like that, but it just doesn't seem to happen. On the whole, they didn't really want to know that things are much worse or much better in one part of the country than the other. They'd like to think it was even spread. So much of this information that was neglected, I'd always been had a slight sort of geographical interest, so it was almost instinctive to start collecting this in the first instance, just as a matter of curiosity. And gradually, as it began to accumulate, I found that patterns did emerge, and one could see underlying certain sorts of clusters of characteristics that there were underlying trends to what one perhaps rather grandiose way might call regional cultures. The sample survey as a method is used in commerce began to develop in the late 1920s, more than we think were done in the advertising media world before the war. It really got going, I suppose, in the 1940s and 1950s. I went into market research in 1955, and it was well established by then, and I suppose there was something already like 15 or 20 independent survey companies, quite apart from the survey subsidiaries of advertising agencies, newspaper companies, and so forth, just when commercial television starting. And the commercial television companies, after their earliest years, had tremendous boom, and money started coming out of their ears. And one way of using up some of this extra cash, almost embarrassing quantity, was to commission large numbers of marketing surveys and distribute them free of charge around the advertising agencies to various potential clients as a way of trying to drum up advertising business. Now, the SALP survey is, of course, a slightly chancy instrument to use as a technique. It's a good deal more difficult to use than appears at first sight. Everybody imagines, for example, they can write a questionnaire until they've tried and actually used it in the street. There are an enormous number of pitfalls. Also, not just in the way questions are posed and the way your questionnaire is constructed, but also in the sampling of the population. It must be completely randomized. It's terribly easy for interviewers to cheat. Cheat by not being entirely random, quite apart from obviously there is a potential for cheating by basically filling questionnaires, what Americans call curbstoning. I suppose the opinion poll, as carried out for many for canvassing political opinions, is the best known form of this commercial survey research. But it has mushroomed into quite a considerable industry now, very sophisticated, using many psychological techniques as well as the original run-of-the-mill ordinary questionnaire sample survey. And not only, of course, is it very widespread commercially now, but it's operated on quite a big scale in government. It began with the wartime social survey, which became the government social survey afterwards, which did most of the surveys for central government. BBC went into it, all the television companies have followed suit, and of course it's now done on a wide scale in local government and academically as well, although it's never been had as much of a big following in academic circles as people expected just after the war, or as has happened, for example, in North America.
So this, I suppose, is partly because of the financial constraints involved. I mean, a lot of the important North American surveyors are involved with commercial companies or doing commercial surveys, whereas here they're not. But I was rather thinking not so much of carrying out one's own survey, but doing what you did, and that was you were interested in regional cultures, in regional tastes and differences within the country itself. And the way you actually set about using the results of other people's surveys for this. In other words, you didn't go out and collect the stuff primarily yourself. But all these market research surveys build up into an enormous archive, which are going to be extremely useful in the future for assessments of changing attitudes over time, quite apart from the regional thing. I mean, there's the comparative thing, there's also the changing attitudes over time. And I wondered if you would say something about how you use them and what kind of problems that other people, you were in market research, so you had a rather easier time of it, what problems of access other people would find.
As I said, I was developing a new form of secondary analysis. When you speak of secondary analysis,
yes,
to, in survey connection, people think of just running the data through and applying more sophisticated techniques or different techniques to rest more information or to rework the data in some way. But very few people seem to have thought of trying to extract more information by putting together reports from a very large number of surveys and juggling around with those findings on this much wider scale. And of course, you really do have to be in the thick of the survey practitioner as well to have access to that very large number. But by the time I began my work, for one reason or another, a lot of surveys were becoming public property, quite apart from the fact, obviously, I had access to a number of ones in a private capacity.
In what sense were they public? You mean they were...
Yes, they had been published. What brought the breakthrough really was commercial television, with so many of these regional marketing surveys carried out with these region-based companies. But this had already begun from the newspaper companies, like organizations like Oldham's Press then, who for over many years produced these reports of different markets based on surveys, which they distributed free to the media buyers, more particularly in the advertising agencies, so with an idea of proving that more readers of their particular newspaper or magazine's case may be, more of them were drinking wine or this, that, or the other,
yes,
and therefore they were a particularly good place therefore for buying space or time on TV. So that with all these reports or surveys being distributed free, it then quite a number of trade associations and bodies of that sort, which have done surveys collectively, so there was public relations value in issuing these things. They drummed up news value. The press loved these tidbits of rather often enticing little bits of information from surveys. And so more and more came out that way as well. And then, of course, there were an awful lot of government surveys as well, of which, from my point of view, the great standby was the National Food Survey, which had been coming out over many years. And perhaps this is a point at which to emphasize that surveys go back a long way in time now. People tend to think of them as a new thing on the whole, very much post-war, but in fact, they do go back, as I said, right back to the 1920s in the earliest time, but some of them go back continuously over long. The National Food Survey goes back over, must be something like 30 or even 40 years now, and been carried out in great detail, and you can study the year-by-year changes in food consumption in a very minute way, and certainly over the more recent years, all this data was broken down regionally, and so one can do these very detailed comparisons. There was, by that time, as I say, enough information coming into the public domain so that by even somebody who wasn't actually placed in the survey world, by going to certain particularly rich libraries, which made a special effort to get a lot of these reports, might have been able, I think, to have got together enough to have made quite a stab at it.
What sort of library would I go to? For example, supposing I was interested in the purchase of different types of flowers in different regions of the country, which, as you know, is an interest of mine, where would I go for initially to have a look, see what surveys have been done in that area?
Well, I have to say, first of all, the sort of thing which we mentioned just then is not probably one which would have been covered by surveys. The survey, they're very sort of weighted on in certain directions, yes, or another, and this point that's worth making. Enormous amount, for example, is known about cigarettes and smoking, thing, because tobacco companies have been extremely survey research conscious, and a lot of the information has been published. But if you wanted to find out about toys, for example, or as you say, garden flowers, then there'd be awfully little indeed. It's rather very patchy in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose the biggest collections of information now would be in one of the advertising libraries, such as the Library of the Institute of Practitioners of Advertising or the Advertising Association. They'd be obvious first places to try. Some of the large commercial libraries have made an attempt to get together quite a lot of these reports. I believe the British Lending Library at Boston Spa was systematically, but I don't know how successful they were. They started rather late on. And some of the big reference libraries, such as that at Manchester Public Library, have also been fairly systematic. But the problem really is that many of these ones which are public released they're privately printed, really often just duplicated. Only a small number of copies are run off because they are just for small private distribution. Their existence is announced on perhaps two lines and a small bottom of column in the professional press, and you'll have to be frightfully quick off the mark to spot them before the supply is exhausted. So many of the public libraries which should have been doing this sometimes when they're coming, we're just not seeing them because they weren't seeing the literature.
Is there a register of them anywhere?
No, the nearest thing, I suppose, to it is the collection associated with the Social Science Research Council Data Archive at the University of Essex, which is the one place in this country which has really built up these collections of past surveys, but it's concentrated on getting the past aggregated data from these surveys.
That's right, it's not the reports.
It's not the literature. Insofar as it's collected the data, it's trying to get the associated literature.
Yes, but if they haven't got the data, they don't have the reports.
On the whole, that's true. No. But they do, of course, have, by now, quite a good index of what exists, and they've got quite a good knowledge of what exists elsewhere, certainly at major surveys, but that, of course, it is rather academically tilted, and they won't know a great deal about the commercial ones.
So it is well worth having looked through the resources of the data archive.
That's
partly because they've got the aggregate data is stored there for reuse, and partly because they know about the reports of other surveys that have been done, even though they don't have it stored there.
And they're hoping to get shortly the back series of the National Food Survey, for example.
Yes.
Some of those important government inquiries.
Yes. So that, I mean, if they're deposited in those places, of course, there's no problem of access or of copyright.
No,
because they are in the public, in the public domain.
Yes.
And there's a lot, an and there's a lot of it in the public domain now.
Yes, and of course there, that's all a computerized archive, and it can all be borrowed reasonably easily by post from the other tapes. It's all make tape.
Yes.
Runs like a National Lending Library.
I see, yes. I wonder if you would say something about if you think there are some other points to be covered in terms of the potential for students on the reuse, as it were, or thinking analysis of this data.
Well, I like to think that the method I was using was rather like aerial photography, and one was using large number of overlays. Of course, by using all these sample surveys, you're getting a bird's eye view of national behavior. Enormous numbers of people involved cumulatively by all these different surveys. You can obviously spot things in this way, which you couldn't possibly spot on the ground, because we're dealing with quite delicate proportions. You know, 40% of women are wearing blue coats, you would say, in one part of the country, and 52% in another region. You can't possibly spot that sort of thing going around on the ground. And this is the only way to get at that. And of course, the great majority of the differences deemed parts of a country like Britain are comparatively minor of that sort, sort of shades of difference. Although there are gross differences as well, more particularly between England and Scotland. Perhaps one of the most interesting ones is this attitude to pig meat, whereby it seems to go back a very long way. But the majority of sausages eaten in Scotland are made from beef, and in England the whole proportion is reversed, mainly pork. And in Scotland they don't have a tradition of eating bacon and other sorts of cooking fats are used instead of lard and all things like that, which suggests that there is this, there's been some sort of taboo against the pig, which it goes back a long way, and a resistance which is very deep. I certainly knew nothing about that until this information began to come through from looking at these surveys, but talking to people, particularly people who know Scottish culture very thoroughly, I find that this is a fact which is known about, which has never really been properly investigated.
David, finally, I think that I'll stop the discussion of the food there, and because I know that Alan wants to ask you something about your other activities, research in the botanical field. Alan.
When people ask me if in the 20th century there are still any people who move between disciplines in the way that 19th century Victorian academics and explorers did, combining archaeology and ethnography and interest in natural history and all these different subjects. When I rack my brains for such people, your is about the only name I can ever think of. And we've talked about your interest in British regional taste and consumer surveys, but I know that you're interested and have written about other topics which appear to our narrow-minded specialists as entirely different and separate. And I wondered if I could ask you about two of these pieces of work. One is to do with physical and historical geography, and is to do with your work on hedge dating. Since people won't be perhaps aware of what this constitutes and the purposes, names and methods, I wondered if you could just very briefly explain how you do it and what its purpose is.
Well, let me first of all disavow that I was in any way the inventor of hedge dating. The honour of that belongs to Dr. Max Hooper of the Institute of Terrestrial Ecology. This goes back now some years when he was professionally investigating hedgerows and wanted to find some way of knowing their dates comparatively. A long-term popular myth had grown up that most of our hedges in this country dated from the agricultural enclosures of the 18th century, which was the sort of common idea. Professor W.G. Hoskins, and all his work on the British landscape, had increasingly been showing that there had been massive enclosures in certain parts of the country, very much earlier dates than that, and had provided strong circumstantial evidence that some of these hedges must go back very, very long periods indeed. And he had one which almost certainly he could point to as coming from the Romano British times. And there was good reason to suppose in some parts of the country these might even go back to Iron Age or even Bronze Age times, more or less undisturbed. So that these two streams of thought met, and when Hooper wanted to investigate this and think of a method whereby he could date some of these hedges, he got in touch with Professor Hoskins, asked him to produce a number of hedges which, from documentary evidence, the date could be stated fairly precisely. These were on Devon ones. It had occurred to Max Hooper that there might be a way of comparatively dating these from their tree and shrub composition, from their botanical composition. And he had noticed that the numbers of these varied, and just superficially, those hedgerows which you could guess were older than others did seem to have rich vegetation, which was perfectly natural, normal thing to assume. But on looking more carefully, and by comparison with these hedges where there were the firm dates for, it began to emerge a most ridiculous thing, that for every, if you take an average sample of a 30-yard stretch of hedge, and take perhaps ideally the average of about three of these 30-yard samples, for extra every shrub and tree species which occurs there, you can add very approximately just almost exactly 100 years. It's too good almost to be true, but it works. It's been validated over a very large number, a very large part of the country, and a very, very large number of hedges now. It breaks down just one or two places where there are known to have been special artificial plantings which have thrown out the actual ratio. Now, why it should work is really something one can only speculate about. It's probably got probability theory at the base there, so that you've got X number of birds flying Y number of years over Z number of hedges. And since most of these tree and shrub species depend on reproduction from bird-carried seeds of one form or another, so that on this purely random basis over time, the dispersal mechanisms are producing this. The arrival theory has it that many of these old hedgerows were cut out of the old woodland at the time of the earliest of clearances, and that a lot of these hedgerows are therefore just the original margins of woodland, which had saved the Anglo-Saxons, for example, the effort of having to construct anew. That may be true to a certain extent, but then you have to assume that these hedges have been gradually losing a few species over time as well, and it gets very complicated. I think the more probable explanation, at any rate in the great majority of cases, is that it is just this random dispersal operating over time. Well, that's been established for the English hedgerows, but of course it doesn't work for when you go west out of England to the particular sod fence zone of Ireland and the Isle of Man and Galloway and far from the Cornish Peninsula, where of course hedgerows of the English type give out. And there you have, instead of a sort of palisade of greenery or forest, you have these dikes built of sods surmounted with some prickly shrubs such as firs or brambles, something of that nature. My discovery was through working on the brambles, which are the most difficult and complex group of plants in the British flora. They reproduce asexually, and therefore there are a number of these true breeding lines, which in a normal sexual species, these minor differences would be bred out through crossbreeding. But because they, once a new species come into being by rare chance hybridization, it becomes, as it were, frozen, and these new strains start reproducing themselves perfectly. They are what we call micro-species, and therefore they have all the differences minutely scaled down, and you really have to get your eye in order to see them. There are a very large number of these in the south of the country, perhaps once dealing with 300 or 400 in a county like Hampshire or Sussex. But as you go northwards in the British Isles, the numbers thin out very considerably. And I specialise these in the Isle of Man, where there are about 42. And I noticed that the average sod fence there had four or five of these common species. Sometimes you get some of these old, obviously older lanes, where it's rather windy and where the banks look distinctly old and have to be broken down. Suddenly the numbers would jump up to 7, 8, or even 9 species, and this straight away it looked as if it was an indication of age. And I actually hit upon this and noticed this before Hooper writes his theory. I'm quite unaware of each other's work. But I couldn't take mine as far as he could his, because unfortunately the area where I developed it, the Ugman, the documentary records don't go very far back, and so one unfortunately can't find very many old hedges where the precise date is known. So this has to be really rather left in the area of speculation for the time being, at any rate. I did have thoughts that one might have been able to get some sort of cross-dating by having some hedges dated by the Hooper method, as it were, on such English hedgerow types which exist in the Isle of Man, and we've got a fix from those onto sod fences dating with the number of brambles, as it were, and one might have got something. But I don't think that would work, and also you're dealing, of course, with an island flora, where everything is likely to be rather distorted just by the mere fact of insulation.
Thank you very much indeed, David. I'm fascinated to find that the peculiarities of the English extend even to their hedgerows, but perhaps just briefly, I know that you yourself have written an excellent pamphlet on the subject, but is there anything else that people could read which would introduce them to this that you can think of?
Well, the best single work is a book called Hedges by Hooper and two other co-authors, which appeared in Collins' New Naturalist series. And that has an excellent summary and it's very well illustrated.
Thank you very much indeed. Can we now turn to another of your characters? That is as a historian of natural history, which obviously is related to what you've been talking about. I know that you recently wrote a book on the history of natural history societies, and this was very widely and well reviewed and has been of use in a recent book by Keith Thomas, for example. But I gather that, as is characteristically the case, reviewers, while applauding your efforts, failed to see what you were actually trying to tell us. And I wondered if you could, for the record, tell us what was at the heart of your book.
Well, I suppose I half got what I was trying to get at. I was trying to construct a sort of scaffolding for the history of natural history, because unlike the history of science more generally, of course, there isn't a great deal of theory in natural history by its very nature, so you couldn't really get a continuous history. You couldn't grasp the subject properly, I felt, if you just concentrated on trying to tell it in those terms. So one did need some organizing principle in its place. I suppose I hit upon two. One of them was to try and get at the fashions which have blown interest in natural history to and fro, and maybe brought some subjects into fashion at certain times, and so forth. So that at some periods there's a tremendous outbreak of interest in butterfly collection, should we say, as another moment birds rise suddenly to a great crescendo of interest, and geology passes out of fashion. These have been vaguely known, but they've never really been studied. And I was interested also to try and find out the influence of wider trends in social movements and so forth, and intellectual passions, how these had influenced the field and tossed it around. That emerged quite clearly, and people can see that. But I also, as a second organizing principle, have been struck by the fact that a lot of the history of natural history was a sort of long-term, half-conscious struggle to organize and to cooperate together to do a form of collective research, what we ornithologists have christened network research. This began very impressively early with the geologists in a period around the sort of 1820s or even slightly before that. And the newly founded Geological Society of London was formed in a great sort of network of local recorders, and people at the centre gathered in all of this information, and with a view to producing great mapping of the exposures throughout the British Isles. Then it was reinvented, as it were, in field botany in the 1830s, 1840s, when H.C. Watson, who was the father of what he called topographical botany, that's a study of how the different species of plants are distributed around the country and what are the factors influencing that distribution. And he organized botanists all around the country to send him in records of what they could find there on using certain special mapping unit, which was he called the Vice County, which was nowadays been reduced just to the dot on a map. And he produced great monographs binding together all this information. But in the process of collaborating like this, he sort of bound together botany in a way. He sort of inspired a whole army of volunteers, and they were content to send in their voucher specimens for the records to the centre and so forth, and he would organise that these were critically examined, and information was fed into a sort of central machinery in a variety of ways. Later on, the ornithologists, as bird watching gradually began to develop, and that's where it rose to its most sophisticated heights. And it was really the study of bird migration brought that into being, because in uniquely in that field, you did have a really conspicuous mystery, and it needed large armies of volunteer observers organized so that they were doing simultaneous, or more or less simultaneous observation, could therefore see these tremendous passage movements. And in the 1880s, this first began to get organized, but it didn't really take off until around the end of the 1920s, when a great inquiry, first of great national inquiries, was one on herons, and a nice conspicuous bird which nobody could mistake, and the great census of heronries was organized. But by that time, they had a journal which could appeal to organizing people, and the motor car had come along, so people could drive off to quite distant parts of the country, and they can assure tremendous coverage. And with these early inquiries in the late 20s and 1930s, many hundreds of observers began to take part. And out of that grew permanent machinery for organizing these inquiries. Government money began to be attracted through research grants because it could be shown that this was valuable for ordinary scientific research purposes. And it was shown that a new scientific technique had been developed by armies of amateur volunteers, and normally amateurs, typically perhaps their efforts coordinated by a professional, not invariably, But by working together in this way, creating this network, they had a tool which no professionals working on their own could possibly hope to emulate. And this new technique has gone on from strength to strength, and it has, in many cases, enormously strengthened the sort of morale and the direction within some of these natural history disciplines, and has in some cases actual organizations like the British Trust for Ornithology have been built around this particular cooperative method. So it has very considerable sociological interest as well.
Thank you very much indeed, David. It reminds me of the story of the birth of history and local history as well at the same time, with the birth of local history societies and people sending in their materials, which is, I suppose, found its last phenomenon in the Cambridge Group for Population and Social Structure, asking amateurs to send in filled in parish register forms and so on. It reminds me also of the early development of anthropology with local district commissioners, yes, and people sending in things from the field of their observations, and then one professional supposedly putting them together. I think perhaps at that point, unless there's anything else you want to say, we'll refer viewers to your book, and thank you very much again.